Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
This is a special episode for me, as Jesse and I speak with an old and cherished friend, perhaps the most influential film teacher of our time. A list of her famous graduates who remain devoted to her is matched only by the caliber of people who seek her out, like Martin Scorsese and Clint Eastwood, who has donated his personal papers to the archive she founded at Wesleyan University. It's a pleasure to welcome her to our podcast. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest today is a very special person, partly because we've known her so long, and partly because she's a special person. Her name is Janine Basinger, and she's been teaching film at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, for a good many years. And along the way, writing wonderful, engaging, opinionated books on American film, the latest of which is the movie musical, which has an exclamation point at the end. I'm not sure how to say that out loud.
It's like the movie Mother. It's Mother! The musical!
You say,
musical!
The movie musical!
Right.
Oh, that was a good delivery. I like it.
You came up with the title.
Well, welcome, Janine.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here. I look forward always to talking to any Maltin.
Well, I'm sad that we're not together in real life because that's much more fun, but this will have to do.
It will. It will do fine. The last time we were together, I think we had great pizza.
We did.
We did indeed. We might as well say where. Frank Pepe's in New
Haven.
It was a great
occasion.
It was indeed. Janine has been teaching and crafting her own courses. And when you and I first met was just around the time in the 70s, somebody out there will remember the 70s, was just around the time that you were teaching a course on women's role in cinema as seen through the films of Joan Crawford.
1971. Mm-hmm. I did that in 1971, and everyone thought I was absolutely crazy. First of all, the attitude in the university was, why would you teach Hollywood films? Why would you even do that? And secondly, why would you do Joan Crawford? And why would you focus on trashy movies like women's pictures? I mean, everybody was aghast. Except for one guy in the history department that really worked with me and put the course in the history curriculum, because at that time there wasn't any film curriculum. His name was Don Myers, and he deserves credit for doing that, although I think he was secretly a big Joan Crawford fan, wouldn't admit it, but did it for that reason. But, you know, that Joan became a friend, and she helped me so much. She was a first-rate film historian and, of course, a really great person on her own movies. She was very, very analytical, critical, objective, And she helped me, you know, because films like Letty Litton at that time, I'd seen everything except something like that. And she helped me with it a lot, explaining clearly, you know, what it was about, what it was like to work in it, about the director, her co-stars. She was great about that. But we survived the course. It was a big hit. The students loved learning about Hollywood and the studio system, were very respectful of her, and she came to campus. The only time she ever made an appearance on a college campus, she was dressed to the teeth. We gave a great event, and the students rose. It was a packed, jammed house, sold out. No, it was free. I mean, no seats were left. And I think everybody on the campus was there, and the students dressed up with, I mean, if you remember the 70s, and as you say, Leonard, there's at least six people out there, I think, who do. it was anti-dress up time. I mean, mm-hmm. God forbid you should ever be dressed up. And they dressed up, some even in tuxedos, and they meant it as a real tribute to her. And she was great with them. She was funny. She was self-deprecating. It was a great event, and there's nothing like it, really, in her career. She just did it as a favor, kind of thanking me for doing this, for taking her career seriously, really. And it was a lot of fun.
And the premise, just so we let everyone else in on it, was that you felt that she personified the different roles that women fulfilled in American society decade by decade.
Yes, I chose her because, first of all, unquestionably, she was a great movie star. She's sort of defines the term. She took her career very seriously, but she was a movie star more than actress anything else. She was also an actress, but a movie star. And from the 20s to the 30s to the 40s to the 60s to the end, to where we were, she had redefined herself first as a flapper, shop girl, you know, soap opera queen, over to horror queen. I mean, she readjusted and kept her career going, and she was very representative of that. And she had been a top box office star. She wasn't an obscure figure or a wonderful actress or a kind of person who didn't make the top 10, you know, in the box office draw. So I thought she was really the perfect example for what I was trying to do. And, you know, a film like Mildred Pierce, in 1971, it's still a great film, but they responded to it so fully. And there are films of hers like The Early Possessed, and for that matter, The 40s Possessed, that none of them knew anything about, or humoresque, that they really, really responded to very positively. And it was, and they loved Johnny Guitar. I mean, it was a great event, really.
And it was a kind of a landmark, what you did, really.
It really was.
Burying the lead, though, both of you. You're both burying the lead on this. What, if you search, I just for the fun of it, I decided to search Janine's name to see what came up. And it said, the godmother of film. And I tease my dad because sometimes when we have friends of his on who he's known forever, he forgets that the rest of the world is not as not as familiar. So the crazy thing about Janine, and there is a crazy thing, is that she really is the godmother of film. And when you speak to some of the most important directors, actors, you name it out there, Janine is the person who opened their eyes, who supported them, who taught them, but more than just as literal teaching, sort of set certain guidelines for how they should behave in this film universe. And when I have friends who go to Wesleyan, and when they realize that we know you, it's like they want to kiss the ring. Because yes, everything you're talking about is so important, and you did things before other people were doing them. Which is why when someone tells me that there were not enough female voices in film a long time ago, I said, I don't think you're talking to the right people.
I agree with that. There were a lot of, but really, I thank you for saying all those lovely things. And I was teaching females on film, teaching about what women directors there were, even Lois Weber and, you know, things like that, way up in front. But that's because I grew up with these things. And, you know, people like, you know, Leonard, you and I, you were a kid when I first met you. I mean, we were so deeply into the roots of Hollywood history. And one of the things that people forget to talk about is that it wasn't really academia that kept film alive, that kept old films alive, put them forward. There were bands of people who were devoted, and a lot of those people, like you, Leonard, like me, like William Everson, and others who began teaching, and academics learned more from that, because we'd been going to Eastman House and going to the museums and sitting around in basements freezing to death looking at, you know, old Charlie Chan movies or something, you know. I mean, and it's a part of the history of film education that gets lost. And of course, we all did it for the passion we had for it. But I had grown up realizing, working in a movie theater, going to the movies constantly, how great American films really were, and how oversimplified so many of the attitudes about them were, but also how very, very stylish they were, how much they presented film as film, treated it with such imagination and creativity, but always with the idea of the audience in mind.
That's right.
The audience must become involved in the story, that you're telling stories and you have to tell a good story. And these things are just so important. I was teaching, you know, Sam Fuller in 1970, Otto Preminger, and you know, these people, Bud Bedeker, these people didn't really become popular in college classrooms until way later. But I grew up with those films, you know.
You are my great example of why you're so good at what you do is that you are a highly qualified academic who grew up ushering in a movie house.
That's right. I learned on my feet.
Anyway, that's your most important credential.
That's right.
It is, and I recommend it to everybody, except now there are no more ushers, and probably with it, and according to the pundits, no more movie theaters in another 5 minutes. They're probably closing all around. Well, in this, the pandemic, they are closed, but isn't it wonderful how great I am? this is all a little bit much for me, but I love movies.
We're not trying to embarrass you. We're just trying to set the stage.
What our audience doesn't know is why you're so important to us and why we will gush all damn day, as will anyone who knows Janine. That's the thing. As I say, Janine holds a very big place in a lot of people's hearts. Now, in our case, you and my dad met when, as you say, he was just a kid.
I think he was in his cradle.
But the part two of that is that you met my mom before my parents got married, and you were one of the first people to give your blessing. So, in our family, and that still means the world to my mother, but in our family, that's part of why not only are you this, I'm going to say, icon in film, but also you're incredibly precious to us. You two talk about when you first met.
Okay.
Well, first, you talk, Leonard.
I have to jump ahead to say one other thing while we're doing resume stuff. Is Janine to building and sort of launching the film department at Wesleyan, which is now quite significant, also started an archive. And you opened that archive with, I believe, three collections. The papers, yes. Frank Capra,
right,
production, his longtime film editor who started out with Max Sennett in the silent film era, William Hornbeck.
Right, right. Oh,
four. And Aaliyah Kazan, who was a Connecticut resident.
Right.
And you had the all the paperwork as well as master tapes of the pioneering TV series Omnibus from right. the producer, Robert Sudeck. So right. that's a hell of a way to start an archive.
It was a good way. Let's put it, we had good calling cards. I mean, we didn't have to explain. I didn't have to say, and, you know, by the way, I have Vita Ann Borg's papers, and I expect to do better. You know, everything went well. You know, with calling cards like Capra, Kazan, you know, people take you seriously right away. And so I was very fortunate to do that. And, you know, it's wonderful. There's nothing, you know, like archive papers for those of us who are loony about film. There's nothing, because, you know, so much of that material never got saved. No one thought of film as a long-term, you know, thing to be. No one saved their papers. No one even saved their films. I mean, it's amazing, you know, really, to think that it's hard to find primary documents in many cases. And so it was great to be able to do that.
And early on, you figured out a clever idea how you could use and at the same time promote the archive. You edited the It's a Wonderful Life book.
Yes.
All from primary materials in the Capra archive.
Yes.
Except for two interviews, which you bamboozled.
Assigned to you. Yes. Well, I knew I could get you, Leonard. I mean, you know, this is what one does. You exploit your old friends, right? I mean, I thought, first of all, I knew that nobody could do as good an interview as Leonard, especially with people, you know, who were in the film business, because he knew everything. So it was wonderful. You enhanced that book, and you did it out of friendship and generosity, too, you know, because it was all a book to raise money to take care of Frank's papers. And
sure,
so
sure.
That was a great project.
It was such drudge work interviewing Jimmy Stewart.
I know. You forced yourself.
His favorite movie and favorite director. And also the cinematographer Joseph Byron, who had been an assistant cameraman and graduated to full-fledged cinematographer on that movie. And
isn't that wonderful?
Well,
yeah, and those are great interviews. And, you know, that book went into multiple printings and lasted for a long, long time. I think it finally has gone out of print, but it's a wonderful book. We put all the material that Frank saved, everything from that film, and there are so many delightful things, such as his handwritten list of possible people to be cast in all the roles. I love that. Only one name under lead actor, Jimmy Stewart, but every other category had other people. And it's just fun for people, especially since so many people love that movie.
Oh, yeah.
See the material. It's a great stuff. It's great stuff.
But so tell our lovely audience how you two met.
Okay.
Well, you tell, Leonard.
Well, I was still living at home with my parents in Teaneck, New Jersey.
Because you were how old?
16, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were 16, yeah.
And one day the telephone rang, and there was this nice woman on the other end of the phone who introduced herself, and she was then working for the Xerox Corporation and fairly recently relocated to Middletown, Connecticut. And was overseeing a publication for students called Read. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, Weekly Reader and Read. Those newspapers for school kids that now nobody thinks about anymore, but were once so important. They really were. But yes, that's what I was doing, and I'd started a children's book club for them. That's what I was doing.
And you had seen some issues of my fanzine, Film Fan Monthly.
Yep. Yes.
And that piqued your curiosity. and mm-hmm. you had no trouble getting my phone number. We were listed.
I love that part.
And so we connected on the phone, no pun intended, and
right.
And then continued talking to each other on the phone. Never a short conversation.
And no, at least 2 hours every enough.
And nothing changed.
It's still like that when we get on the phone.
That's true.
Yeah. And I had to wait until I had a driver's license.
Yes, to come visit me. Isn't that funny? I was appalled. What, you don't have a driver's license? Here he was editing this magazine, and he knew absolutely everything about not only old films and old film stars, but radio and old music and recordings and everything. And I thought, and he doesn't have a driver's license? What the heck? That was amazing. That was astonishing. It really was.
So you finally got your license, which meant you could go visit Jeanine.
Yes, so I could go and visit Jeanine.
And then it did. And, we would come for the weekend. We would have fun.
That's right. That's right. And I think your daughter Savannah was about 3
I believe she was. Yeah. She's now in her 50s. Well, you know, no, we don't. It's like she's 14 now. Here's the thing. And then I remember the day you brought Alice. And, you know, I think that was not the first time I'd met Alice. I'm a little hazy since I'm elderly. But I knew from the moment I met Alice, this woman is fabulous. And I thought, if Leonard lets her get away, I'm just going to have to beat him up. I mean, I'm just going to have to sit him down and beat him up. But as I watched the two of them together, I thought, no, there's no way he'll let her get away. It was clear they were in love from the beginning. And I loved Alice from the first minute I met her. And I also respected her so much. I saw so much in her. And I thought, perfect, perfect, perfect for Leonard. And wasn't I right? Yes.
But you set a good example, because you and your husband, John, have had a long, successful marriage as well.
And, that's true.
And with the utmost respect for each other, not just caring for each other and loving each other, but admiring each other's work and being proud of each other.
Yeah, it's luck when you have... when you come from a good marriage, you, as I did, you can know one when you see one, and then you can be a good, you know, kind of show other people the possibilities. And, you know, this is like apparently gets rarer and rarer, but you can always sort of tell when you see a couple. It's that mutual, it's respect for each other's ideas, opinions, work, and it's the joy in sharing ideas and things with each other. It's that old cliche of like, and you know this is true, you go out for dinner as a couple and, you know, you can barely, you're yakking away to each other, you know, interrupting each other because you have so much to say. And across the room is a table where you see a couple, obviously married, who are eating without speaking to one another, and you look over there and you think, what is going on over there? I mean, you know, it's that kind of thing. It really is. It's great.
Now, over the years, since you launched your archive with such a great foundation of collections, you have attracted some other pretty eclectic and high profile donors of their papers and memorabilia, ranging from John Waters, the Bard of Baltimore.
Yep, absolutely.
To Clint Eastwood.
Yep.
And
Ingrid Bergman.
And the family of Ingrid Bergman donated all of her papers.
Yeah.
And others.
Marty, we have a lot of Marty's things. Marty Scorsese has things elsewhere, you know. But we do have wonderful archive, really. And it's great to be able to save these things. And our students, of course, can work with the papers and see things and read scripts. We have Raoul Walsh. We have a very eclectic collection. And when we asked John Waters, it was in way back. I mean, he had not yet gained full responsibility, full respectability, I should say. And he was delighted that we would come and ask him. And he's such a great person. He's a collection that he has is phenomenal, interesting, original, covers so many areas. And of course, the joy of asking Clint Eastwood and having him say yes. Although he took time, he said, I have to think. He said, this was way, way back. And he said, when someone comes and asks you for your archive, it makes you feel old. I think he was about 50 then. And of course, now this is 40 years later. But people were great about I think the calling cards of Capra and Kazan were always amazing, but I think that we always presented. I always presented our archive as it's not going to be the biggest, it's not going to have everything, but it's going to be a little gem of an archive. We're going to take really good care of everything. It's going to be under proper temperature and humidity control. It's going to be lovingly. It's not going to get lost. We're not going to take so much stuff that we can't take good care of it. And it's going to be used in the classroom properly, and students are going to be studying your films, or your films are the films our students are studying, like Gene Tierney. We teach a lot of Gene Tierney movies. We were teaching John Whale movies. We were John Waters movies. We were teaching Clint Eastwood movies, and not everybody was doing that at that time, so it was a great experience building that up.
You also had to raise funds to build an appropriate building to house the archive and to have all those temperature, humidity controls, and all those safeguards.
Yes, we did. Yeah, we did. We had to get it up out of the basement. I mean, it's great that our alumni, the Wesleyan film majors, the students that we taught, really stepped up to the plate in every possible way. And friends that people that went to Wesleyan that I didn't teach, who became friends and supporters, like Gordon Crawford and Stuart Reed, people who were names would be known by, it was wonderful, really, how we now have just finished phase three of this huge, complex that we have that houses the archive and state-of-the-art movie theaters built to THX 11 standards. If you're studying Lawrence of Arabia at Wesleyan, you're looking at it in 70 millimeter. And, that's unusual for a college campus. And I'm very proud of that. Naturally, that's the motivation of a former movie usher that
yes.
I wanted the films big and at the proper aspect ratio, So it's really great.
That's like a four-letter word. When my dad walks into a room, and it's like you'll see him twitching. He goes, "It's not the right. It's flat.
I know. It just makes you crazy, doesn't it? Well,
it does.
Especially those of us old school, we opened our biggest movie theater with a showing of Singing in the Rain. I said, you have to have a good luck omen for your first screening. You need a hit. You need an audience pleaser. You need something cheerful. So, you're blessing your theater with all good things. And they had a 187, and I was like, no, it doesn't, no. And everybody turned to me and said, no, you're wrong. This is correct. And I thought, these young people are telling me I'm wrong. I was there when I ushered for Singing in the Rain. I know what it's supposed to look like. But, it doesn't. You can't even look at it. It's a weird thing. You just can't even look at it.
My dad's embarrassed by our kitchen TV because it's quite small. and it's always at the wrong ratio. So sometimes if I go to, like if we're watching a movie on, it's on while we're having dinner or something, and I go to take a picture, he goes, oh, don't post that. I don't want people to think that I watch things in the wrong ratio.
Absolutely right. Now, the TV we have here at our house in South Dakota is like that. And they look fat. They look like they have heads that are pumpkins. When they're in profile, their heads become pumpkins because it stretches out. It just doesn't look right. Oh, it makes me crazy. No one else seems to notice this, Leonard.
No one else bothers. Can I tell my favorite story about your archive?
Yes, you may. Whatever it is.
Something wrong. Okay. Many years ago, there was a woman who was the director of the Museum of Modern Art film department named Mary Lee Bandy. May she rest in peace.
Yes.
And she had in MoMA's collection, for some reason, they had received the papers of Kay Francis, who is little remembered today, but was a very big star in the 1930s, especially the early 30s. And Mary Lee realized that it would be more appropriate for that collection to reside at Wesleyan and offered it to you. And you said, great. Well, Kay Francis's mother was Catherine Gibbs, the founder of a famous series of
schools,
secretarial schools. That name means little today, but Catherine Gibbs secretarial schools were very, very popular at one time in the 20th century. So Kay Francis, having learned from her mom, kept all of her diaries in shorthand, in various styles of shorthand.
Yes, and she mixed different styles, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
So that it would be difficult to encrypt, to unencrypt, I guess. What's the word?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah.
Decipher.
So you took a classified ad in your local newspaper and found an elderly woman who indeed still had the skill of taking and reading shorthand. And you hired her to work.
Yes, Leonard, I had to find three women. one who did the Gibbs style, one who did, one who could, I've had to find one who could do all three styles she had mixed. And so the three of them had to sit down together. It was a real challenge. It wasn't just, she took it in a mixed form. So I had to find three people. So that really was a challenge. Go on.
But the punchline is that Miss Francis had many amorous adventures, shall we say, in Hollywood, all of which she detailed, up to and including abortions. And these women who were deciphering the shorthand could be heard in the corner of your library room going, oh, what?
And in some cases where Francis used, shall we say, slang terms for activities, amorous activities, they were deeply confused. And they would come to me and say, I think we're doing this wrong because she said blank, 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 Errol Flynn, blank, blank, blank. And it doesn't seem to make any sense. And I would swallow hard and say, just write it out the way you think it was and I'll sort it out later. Because they were so naive. They had never heard these terms before. That was a source of great amusement amongst all of us at Wesleyan for quite a long time. But they translated faithfully and beautifully, those three women. They were quite charming.
And now people can have access to those papers.
So they talk can. About class, Janine. Talk about the class that has become infamous, including the rules, which this is my favorite part.
Well, I always told my students that if you if you're going to work in the film business, you've got to learn to be punctual, to be reliable, to, you know, come on time and everything. So I never allowed latecomers, and I've locked the door on them. And I, you know, I'm famous for this, and, you know, over the years it became like, she's terrible, you know, which never bothered me. I figured they're not going to hold a job if they can't show up on time. I forget which rules, you know, which ones are you. One of my students was in a play where, through some ghastly error, instead of a trick knife being used to stab him, someone actually stabbed him. And as he fell to the floor, he said, "Tell Janine I won't be in class tomorrow." he was afraid I would throw him out, which is, I think, a pretty, pretty colorful anecdote and tribute to my... But, you know, I do think you set a tone in a classroom, whether... you take it seriously. I always said, I'll be here no matter what, and I need you to be here too. There's a kind of, I know this is old fashioned, and but I just kind of feel that the business hasn't changed in that regard, and people become film majors because they want to work in the business in film or TV or something, and they need to learn. It's a serious business, time is money, and you just have to learn that. So I always tried to set that. What anecdote were you thinking of? There's so many, and I'm so old, I can't remember them all.
No, it's just that when you first started teaching,
kids are not allowed to miss class.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely not.
The attendance was mandatory, and one of your or supervisors said, well, you're not going to be able to enforce that. And you said, no, I am. And you sort of laid it down as a ground rule and never had to say it again.
Mm-hmm. Never. And I also said, I will not accept late papers. I'm going to tell you the first day of class, the day that, you know, I'm going to have things due, handed in, so start planning now. If you don't make it, I don't need your paper. Just forget it. I mean, this is the deadline. And again, everybody said, are you crazy? They were all giving extensions. And, you know, that's a joke if you give an extension. You know, it's going to be like when they're 42, they may get it back to you. But I never had a late paper. I never had to deal with those things. They took it seriously because I took it seriously, and they knew I meant it, that I was like, you know, I didn't train to be an academic. I, of course, you couldn't in my day. When I was in college, you couldn't be a film major. It didn't exist. And so I just kind of had an attitude about it, which is, look, we've got to take this seriously. I don't need to do this for a living. I can do something else. So let's take it seriously, because then we can all care and enjoy it. And I must say, my students worked terribly hard and always cared and gave me their best. And we had so much fun doing that hard work together. It was, you know, teaching is a joy and a privilege, really. And when you take it seriously and they take it seriously, it's a wonderful, wonderful relationship. They teach you. I've learned so much from my students.
Yes,
they give back so much, you know?
Now, go ahead, Jess.
I think that I really do believe that, you know, college is that middle point when you're still a bit of a kid because you don't have real life responsibilities you know, you're almost an adult, you're almost a kid. It's a transition time, you know? It's the period in your life where you start to learn how to be a person on your own. And I think that when you set guidelines like that and you said, no, I'm going to treat you like an adult, I'm going to treat you like a professional. And, you know, so that means I expect certain things of you. And if you can't do it, that's okay. But then you shouldn't be here.
That's,
you know,
right.
And that's all right. It's no judgment that,
no,
you know,
that's right.
But here are the rules. And I feel like sometimes if you don't ask people to step up, then they won't. But if you plainly, and everyone has the exact, you know, it's not like it's just you, it's everyone here makes an agreement. And I think that's part of it. I think that that for students, and certainly having spoken to so many of your students through the years, that's how they felt, was this is important.
I agree with what you're saying. And also, you know, Jesse, a person such as myself who lays down these rules, I'm not rigid. If there was a genuine reason for something, came to me, yeah, you know, then you can make an exception, but you make exceptions. They are specifically made and agreed upon exceptions that are necessary, so that you don't just constantly hear the dog ate my paper, which of course has become the computer ate my paper. The dogs used to eat their papers. I don't know what happened to those dogs, but now they probably died of paper diet, but the computer now is my computer crashed, is the modern era's the dog ate my paper. It's so easy to not do the work. And I also returned the papers, everything they gave me, with one full page of single space typed comments and, you know, critiques of what they had done. So it inspired people, I think, to really put a lot of effort into their papers because they knew they were going to get a lot back. I did that because when I was in college, and I had wonderful teachers and I had a really good experience in college, but I would often get, I worked hard in school, I cared about it, and I would get back a very good, and I would think, very good? I mean, wait, can't you at least say, I love the part where you said, you know, but it's like, wait, very good? So I thought, if I'm going to teach, I'm not doing this very good thing. I'm going to really get in there and talk about the work they did and what was good about it, what was not as good, where they could maybe go, or here's some other films you could see or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, you've had an illustrious roster of students over these many years, and they seem to just keep coming. I didn't realize Lin-Manuel Miranda was a Wesleyan guy.
Yep, he is. Now, he was not a film major. He did apply for the film major, and he's been very generous, saying he didn't have the grades for it. And, you know, but like as if anybody would imagine that he wasn't smart. But he hung around with film majors and was always around doing things. And I saw his In the Heights that he did on the campus. And, he's a great a lot of wonderful people who were not film majors have, you know, as Akiva Goldsman, the Oscar-winning writer and producer, was not a film major, but he hung around with film majors, took film classes, et cetera. And someone once asked when he had returned to campus, were you a film major? And he hesitated, and I said, yes, he was a film major. I said, because as soon as you win the Oscar, you become a film major. But he said yes. But, you know, the majority of all these people were film majors, but there are a lot of great people who were in the culture of the film major, but not actually, you know, taking the major. So that's something, because there are a lot of other good departments at Wesleyan besides film, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what you got me for my bat mitzvah?
No, remind me. Great, I'm sure.
I loved Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Forgotten that? Yes.
And you had the whole cast and Joss sign this for me for my bat mitzvah. It's in my art room right now.
That's so cool.
And that was the neat opening it up, and you put it in this lovely little box. And I remember opening it up and genuinely screaming. You know, everybody else wanted, it was the time of the Tiffany bracelet, that heart little Tiffany bracelet. Everybody got that. I was over the moon for this.
Yes.
It was
well, you got something no one else had. Well, here's the thing. Wasn't it nice of Joss to do that for me? I mean, Joss Whedon, of course, was my student, one of my very, very best students, I might add. And he and I are still very close, and we talk all the time. He's just a terrific person. And Buffy, just so wonderful, that show. So great. And it had such a grip on all of us. I loved it. I mean, I loved that show myself. Wonderful, wonderful show. But there's also, I think there's a photo I have of you and your mom and dad and Joss taken at an event that was at CAA. I think, yeah. I actually have a picture of you with Joss somewhere. I'll have to see if I can find that.
If we could burn every photo of me from approximately 9 to 24, that would be great.
No, Jesse, that's true for all of us.
But you have these parties, and that too was such a significant thing. And it was where I would see Joss a few years in a row, and getting to talk to him was so cool. You know, but all your go through. Come on, talk about some of the different that.
Well, I always get the two Weitz brothers mixed up or confused when it comes to which one.
Paul was my student, and what a fabulous, fabulous student and dear friend he's remained all these years. And, you know, he would always invite me out to lunch, and we would go across the river, which is sort of like, you know, Tijuana. I mean, go across the Connecticut River to Cromwell instead of staying in Middletown, and eat a lunch at a sort of shady dive place so that we could sit there a long time and talk all about all the things we wanted to, you know. And he was just a wonderful companion and conversationalist, and still has been a great supporter, very great guy, really. I've had so many smart, wonderful students that, you know, just thinking about it, I always dread it, because I think I'll start naming them and there's so many, then I'll forget someone important and then I'll feel guilty.
Well, another of your students paid you unusual tribute because in the second Transformers movie, you have a cameo appearance because of your student Michael Bay.
That's right.
And it's a very funny cameo, but only if you know Janine. Because it makes no sense otherwise. And at the screening, the press screening I attended, I was sitting next to Todd McCarthy, whose wife Sasha is a graduate,
and a film major. Yeah.
Right, and so he and I both chuckled loudly to the great mystery of the people around us, because Shia LaBeouf is having some sort of an incident. He's acting out and doing something strange in class, and the professor says, please stop this. This is unseemly behavior. And on the day the dean is visiting, cut away to you.
Yeah, I'm the dean.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's right. I slapped my cheeks. Oh, and you know, I went to visit Michael on the set, and this was shot at Princeton. And, you know, Michael, I think, is what you call a tough director. Mm-hmm. And the day I was there, when we were working on that, he took a break and he brought me on that little stage, and he said, holding my hand, we walked out, he said, I want everybody to meet, this is my teacher. And when he said, this is my teacher, their jaws dropped about 8 feet. And then they all cheered wildly because they were so thrilled that he was, you know, that he was being gentle with me. And he's always been very, very good to me. And I have a lot of respect for him. He's a hard worker and very talented filmmaker. In fact, that some people don't like the kind of films he makes, he is still a great filmmaker. And I, you know, he's been a great supporter of the building that we have, the theater, the things that we've done at Wesleyan. It's been great to have him. And, but it was a lot of fun to be in those things. And I've been in a former student of mine named Scott Wiper made a film, A Better Way to Die. And my husband and I are both in it. And in the first scene, I'm asked to hang laundry. We're a sort of rural couple. I'm supposed to hang laundry on the clothesline with clothespins. And they handed me the stuff. And my husband said, oh, excuse me, she's going to have a stunt double. You know, just the idea of me hanging laundry on a line was like, what?
But
they're great, and they do. You know, it's a funny thing. People remember that close up from the Transformers because it is very odd, and a lot of people, you know, see me, and they even some people who are great fans of the movie who've watched it multiple times have asked me, wait a second, have I seen you? Because there it is, you know, it's nothing but me. It's very funny, but it's great. It's great. They're good about stuff like that.
It's a wonderful credential. One of the earlier books that you, we plugged the movie musical. No, I didn't do it right. The movie musical.
There you go.
Yes, there you go.
Right. But one of your landmark books, and I love them all, it's called A Woman's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women, 1930 to 1960. And this taught me, this opened my mind. And I can't say that about an awful lot of books, but yours did, because you made a really important point for somebody who's an old movie buff, which is that even though the men who mostly ran the business, the Hollywood industry at that time, insisted on the sort of stereotypical picture of the American home and the nuclear family and all of that, which meant that at the end of a movie, a woman had to get married, submit to convention or conventionality, that's not what you take away from so many of those movies. Because 95% of the movie is about strong, assertive, capable, exceptional women, played by strong, capable, exceptional women like Barbara Stanwyck, Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, Carol Lombard, and the list goes on and on and on. So that's the mixed message that they send out. So there was kind of a hypocrisy.
Absolutely.
A hypocrisy.
Really.
Positive.
Absolutely. I mean, do people who go to the movies believe that last minute little conversion, or that when you've spent the rest, you know, an hour and a half watching something else? I mean, do a few little words change everything that you saw and believed in? And also, of course, I have my own experience. I was a steady film goer from very early childhood onward, because in those days everybody went to the same movies. I mean, my parents did. My mother didn't like the idea of me going to horror films, but she frequently was confused. For instance, the Cat People suggested to her a lovely group of old ladies who had cats, and so she let me go. And of course, I was terrified out of my wits by the Cat People, but loved it. But the thing is that, you know, I was allowed to go to the movies. Everybody was allowed to go, and you saw everything, and you went with your parents sometimes. And so I saw these movies, and, you know, as a child, you're forming your ideas from the life around you, which is frequently from children hidden away. Adults keep things from you, and you kind of know something's going on, but you don't know what or whatever. But in the movies, they just laid it out there, and you could see, And so you saw all of these very strong actresses and women, and these films were built around these actresses. They were front and center. They were made to be stories about women, and you saw they were flying airplanes, they were inventing things, they were saving lives as doctors, they were editing newspapers, they were tycoons in business. I mean, and so that sort of became your idea of your life. It wasn't that you didn't think you were going to be married or have children. It's just that you had other things you were going to do. And so all of my friends and I always thought about, what are we going to be in life? We assumed, of course, we'd be wives and mothers, but what else would we be? And we were using these things as role models. And I remember, and I talk about this in that book, very distinctly seeing the film Ladies Courageous, which is a Loretta Young movie where women are playing bomber pilots who are ferrying bombers across to England during World War II. And the film opens up with Loretta Young, with a pilot landing dangerously a plane on a schoolyard because for some reason she's been forced down, but we don't know it's a woman yet. And the little girls in a convent school run to the window to look out, little girls with braids and little school uniforms. And as they watch, the pilot climbs out and takes off the helmet and out falls all her hair, and they realize it's a woman and they all go, oh, and then she talks to them and she says, you know, you can fly free as the bird flies if you wish to. You can fly free and be free, and it's up to you to make the choice. And that had a very strong effect on me. And as I said in the book, I knew the choice I wanted to make when I saw that. And, you know, these are things that people, you know, want to oversimplify the Hollywood past. There's a gigantic tradition of strong women in movies dominating the scene, doing everything and living lives other than lives as wives and mothers. I mean, and so, you know, that influenced a generation. It might be said that the whole 1960s women's movement were people who saw those same movies that I did as a child, and they were very liberating, those films.
And still are.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And those actresses, how great are they? How great is Barbara Stanwyck? That woman, she was never bad.
No. A remarkable actress. And we've been revisiting, Alice and I have been revisiting some films on Turner Classic Movies and on some Blu-rays. And she just never lets you down.
She can do anything. She can sing and dance. She can play comedy with impeccable timing. She can give a really tough, hard character, dramatic role, and a very soft, vulnerable, dramatic role. The woman can do anything. She's amazing. She really is.
Yeah. Now, you got to meet your childhood favorite,
yes.
Betty. Tell
Betty
us about
Grable. Well, first of all, I just, you know, grew up watching Betty Grable movies. And for those who don't know, she was the World War II pinup queen. She was the number one. She was in the top 10 box office draw for a decade, year after year, which is very hard for a woman to maintain in those years. And she was just a happy, bright, lovely creature with a gorgeous smile, who looked fabulous in Technicolor, and whose movies were very lightweight, charming entertainment, particularly for a young girl growing up. And I did meet her, and I got to, we had her for lunch. I practically bought a new refrigerator. I was so excited. The idea I was having Betty Grable to my, you know, for lunch was just so wonderful. But it was a really thrilling thing to meet her and talk with her about her career and to get to know her. And we kept in touch over the years. she had many fans that she kept in touch with much more closely than I did with her. But it was really, I think she was the first really big movie star that I had loved as a child that I got to know. And John and I were there in the front row when she opened on Broadway and Hello, Dolly. And it was just a lot of great experiences. And I also had a great experience learning about how important movie stars really were to people. When I was in London on business at one point in about the mid 60s, I didn't know anyone, and I didn't have anything to do at night. And I saw that at the Mayfair Hotel, they had a little film thing down in the basement, and they were showing Betty Grable in Footlight Serenade. And Footlight Serenade was one of the few films of hers I hadn't seen. It was just a little bit before I was really going all the time. I thought, oh my gosh, well, I'm just going to go. So I went down there and I came in, and there was a room full of men there, and they looked at me oddly, and I sat down in the back row, and they kind of whispered among themselves. And finally, one of them came back and said, excuse me, but, you know, may we ask why you're here? And I said, well, I came to see Betty Grable in Footlight Serenade. And they were like, what? You like Betty Grable? And I'm like, yes. Well, it turned out it was a men's club, most of whom were former RAF pilots who had a club, and they showed Betty Grable movies. And it was, the hotel wasn't supposed to really be listing it because it was a private group. But once I said I love Betty Grable, I became their mascot. And I still write to the remaining two of those men. The Christmas letter I got from one of them said, my wife is gone. I'm not well. You know, it's like we've been writing to each other for years, and that's what Betty Grable could do. It's something that you don't quite have the equivalent of today. Stars are still important, but there's something about the older stars and the people who gathered around them, connecting them to memories and to the events of their lives, that is shared. And it's a link to your youth. It's a link to friends. It's an amazing thing. But we corresponded all these years, and it was a great experience.
Oh, what a wonderful story. And then you and I had an extraordinary experience, and Alice too, when we got to take June Haver to lunch.
Great. Tell about that, Leonard. Tell about that. That was so wonderful.
Well,
I still have those pictures.
Oh, yeah, me too. June Haver, again, not widely remembered today, perhaps, but she was a beautiful blonde actress who, in fact, was signed to a contract at 20th Century Fox as a threat to Betty Grable.
Yes.
It was also said that Daryl Zanuck, who ran the studio, never wanted any of his big stars to get too cocky or lest they demand more money, more perks, whatever it was. So he always had someone in the wings waiting, grooming them for stardom. And that was June Haver, and who was very appealing and very talented. And I'd gotten to meet, I forget how I got, well, I met her daughter. That's how I met her. I met her daughter at an event, and I told her we had this huge advertising sign for Royal Crown Cola that featured her mom. And she got such a kick out of that. And so that's how I got to meet June. And I knew that you would appreciate meeting her too. So we all went to lunch, and she started telling us some of her life story, which you were able to fill in as she went along.
Yeah, I did.
Career.
And this
is a young woman who was ready to forsake her Hollywood career, which was going well, to join a convent.
Yeah.
Because she had such a heartbreak was it her boyfriend or fiance who died?
Dr. John Guzik, I believe it was her fiance, but she had had an earlier unhappy short marriage with a musician, and when she paused, almost as if she couldn't remember his name, I remembered it was Jimmy Zito, and that's what floored her. But it was great, wasn't that? She was wonderful, and you know, I have never forgotten one of the things that she said that she told us that day, which stunned me, left me utterly speechless. This is a really lovely woman and an intelligent, caring woman, June Haver, and she had her head screwed on right, I would say, and she suffered quite a lot, although had a very happy long marriage to Fred McMurray from that time on to the end of her life. But I was thinking, gee, think of all the people she knew in Hollywood and saw at 20th Century Fox. And so I said, tell me who was probably the most impressive person that you met in your years, thinking, oh, I'm going to hear Jean Tierney or, you know, whatever. And she said, Ava Perón. And I about fell off my, now there is the least expected answer.
Yes.
I did not expect June Haver, the musical comedy star of 20th Century Fox, to tell you Ava Perón was the most impressive. And that was wonderful. Then she told us stories about Ava Perón. Of course, she'd met her when going on a junket to Argentina for 20th Century Fox. But do you remember that, Leonard? That was a great moment.
Yes. I subsequently interviewed her about that junket, which was not a life-changing experience, but an unforgettable experience for her. And it was so wonderful to get some details and hear more about it. We were very lucky to have that day.
It was a wonderful day for all of us, you and Alice and I, and who've shared many happy memories and days. And then to have it with her was very, very special. It really was. And we've had so many of those things, Jesse. I hope you like hearing about them, because we're certainly filling you full of them. But it's a great thing that movies create not only happy memories and great experiences in meeting people like June Haver, but they foster friendships of the sort that Leonard and Alice and I have had, Jesse, and also you, getting to know you and see you grow up. It's a wonderful thing, isn't it, really?
And it has something to do with the nature of stardom then.
Yes.
And the nature of stardom today. Today, we don't put stars on a pedestal.
They don't mean the same thing, right?
Yeah. We may still be fans or admirers. That will always be true. But somehow back in those days, before the era of talk shows and getting to know people or getting to feel like you know people,
right.
It's an illusory thing, but you feel like you know them a little bit. And in that era, you didn't feel like you knew them. You looked at them from far.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, when you go to some place like Hearst Castle, and they talk about the parties that he threw on the weekends and all of the stars who would come up. And you think that, to me, for me, that is Hollywood in a nutshell. That's what I imagine, is the stars, you know, in their beautiful homes going to these extravagant parties. And they almost weren't real. And that's also why getting to speak to the different people that we've, you know, that you introduced me to, you know, it's absolutely fascinating. And no matter how many times they try to make movies about it, documentaries, there's just sort of no way to capture that time when the studio system was what it was, which a remarkable machine, you know, it's.
Which inspired another wonderful book called The Star Machine, which Janine wrote, and which I can recommend heartily to you. And because you really broke it down into how they built those stars. There was a bit of science to it.
Yeah, and it was a wonderful accidental process. I mean, they had a plan and they executed it, but they knew it, you know, it's kind of like buckshot, you know, they would shoot it out there and then the ones that stuck to the wall, you know, or whatever, they would then really promote those. But they had a process for getting them ready and putting them out there. And if someone was identified by the public as someone of interest, then they had a second level of process that elevated them. It was both a business and science and an art and an accident, you know. It's really wonderful to think about it. And I liked what Jesse said, you know, it's true that they were more distant. I mean, they were like living in a different place. They were in a different world. Whereas nowadays, of course, they're more treated like humans and not their mistakes and their peccadilloes are not, their clay feet are not kept from us as secrets. In those days, they were presented as stars with the persona that they felt was appropriate that we wanted to buy. So when you met one of them, it really was an amazing experience. And it's yes, different, yeah.
Well, different. We better not delve any deeper into the memory
box. Won't. We'll yes,
never
no.
stop.
No, we'll never stop. And Leonard, we never will stop. Jesse, we never will stop. Alice, we never will stop. I want to say we talked way too much about me and how wonderful I am. But you guys are wonderful, all of you Maltons. And I really thank you for having me on. It was a lot of fun, as it always is when I get to talk to you.
Well, mm-hmm. Vice versa.
And we can't wait to see you and hug you and be together.
You bet. And hug, right? All right. Shall I say goodbye? Go ahead. What?
No, you have to listen to us do our closing.
Okay. Oh, all right. Then I'll shut up. A very difficult challenge for me, I might add.
The price you have to pay, Jesse.
Yep.
You can follow me and my dad on Instagram and Twitter at Jesse Malton, at Leonard Malton. You can always go to Facebook and follow my dad. You can check leonardmalton.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff. We will very happily, when this episode airs, also post something on the website with links to all of Janine's books. So that's an easy way for you to find it. Go to leonardmalton.com.
And we are on Patreon.
Maltreon.
Which is... Patreon.com slash Malton on Movies. Patreon.com/Malton on Movies if you want to support the kind of stuff we do. And we're going to keep doing it anyway. And Janine, thanks once more.
Oh, thanks to you and lots of love to the whole family, okay?
Okay,
thanks,
back
Janine.
At you.
Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.